And we'll move to the next case, which is the Cano. It's 2013 SC-209. I'm going to say Cano, correct me if I'm wrong, versus the people. This is set for an hour, so each council has a half an hour. May I have the interview appearance, please, from Mr. Cano, is it?
Yes.
Council? All right, thanks. Thank you very much. Good morning. Ms. Brady?
Christine Brady, registration 24779 of the name of the people.
Okay, and as I said, this case is set for an hour. Mr. Lorenzo, when you're ready, may I go ahead, sir? You have 30 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, Gregory Lansky for Mr. Cano. Like the West case, this case involves a post-conviction conflict claim. The facts are a little different in Mr. Cano's case. We're dealing with simultaneous representation of the same regional office specifically. While Mr. Cano's attorneys were representing him, other attorneys from the same public defender's office were represented and endorsed the subpoenaed witness from both by the prosecution and the defense, Sergio Aguilar.
Mr. Lansky, could I ask you a favor? Can you pull the microphone up a little bit?
Higher?
Yeah, okay. Right side.
And sure. Talk more into it. We're really having a hard time. I think all of us here are mute, so.
Okay.
You might, in fact, want to start over. Because we could hear.
And this was raised in a post-conviction claim, and the court held an evidentiary hearing where both of Mr. Cano's attorneys testified. The court denied his conflict claim. It did it on a basis of a Strickland claim. This issue was raised in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals reversed the district court's decision on Strickland, saying this was an issue of multiple representation, and indicated that the Collier standard applies in this situation. But when doing so, the court provided specific remand instruction to the district court, and that is the subject of both Mr. Cano's petition and the state's court's petition. And specifically, what the Court of Appeals did, they instructed the district court, in order to prove an adverse effect, they provided a formula. The formula was, Mr. Cano has to show something the council did or did not do, and that action was influenced by the conflict. In addition, the court said when you apply the court standard, you have to apply a computation document which was in place at that time, Rule 1.10, which was in existence at the time of Mr. Cano's trial. And I heard the West Council's argument for West, and my argument is slightly different. I have faith in this court. I have faith that this court knew what it was doing in Castro. I have faith that this court understood Collier and Sullivan. And I say that because this court understood that an adverse effect was required. And that adverse effect was actively representing competing interests and duties and loyalty was imposed to those opposing interests. With the adverse effect that this court essentially articulated was that council had to make decisions under the constraint of inconsistent duties. That's the adverse effect. And that's what Castro said, essentially, in its opinion. And Higgins, which was decided in 2002, did nothing to describe what is required by the adverse effect. And to understand why this court was right in Castro, you have to look at the duty of the constitutional right to counsel. And the constitutional right to counsel, its basic function is to provide the defendant with a fair trial and also to protect the integrity and legitimacy of the proceedings and make sure the convictions are done, in a way that the public can feel secure about it. The most fundamental aspect of the right to counsel is the duty of loyalty. Okay? And when that duty of loyalty is impaired and infringed, you adversely affected the representation because you now deny a constitutional right to the defendant. And that's what this court said in Castro. It was absolutely correct. And to show that it was correct, you look 30 years later, post-Mickens, you look at the highest court of New York State, they had the same conflict analysis and conclusion as Castro. The same exact thing that this court did in 1982 or 83 when it decided Castro. The New York highest court did the same analysis and the same conclusion as the court of Castro, post-Mickens. They found an actual conflict necessarily equates into an adverse effect. And Mickens even supports Castro because Nickens doesn't say it's a two-part inquiry. You don't define a conflict and an actual conflict and an adverse effect. It said a conflict is an adverse effect. An actual conflict is an adverse effect. And that's what this court did in Castro. It's correct. This court was on point.
Could I ask you to try to narrow down exactly what you're arguing here? And given what you just said, do you mean to suggest that anything that would constitute a conflict under the rules of professional conduct would automatically carry with it an adverse effect?
No. As the Solomon said in Castro, the conflict has to operate on representation. It has to surface on representation. It has to have some sort of encumbrance in the decision-making process of counsel.
Do you think, since we're talking about Tyler here, has the U.S. Supreme Court ever found it automatic that there is prejudice or an adverse effect, that you don't have to separately show it in any situation other than multiple representation of co-defendants at the same trial?
Well, that's Holloway. In Holloway, the Supreme Court indicated that when you have multiple representation, and Holloway, it was never found to be an actual conflict, it's only a potential conflict. And it's when counsel didn't object to this potential conflict, but joint representation does not always, you know, cure a conflict. They could have a common defense. But because if there was a potential conflict and defense counsel objected to it, then there was automatic reversal in joint representation. So the issue really is whether it's an actual conflict or a possible conflict.
And how do you resolve that? What does the U.S. Supreme Court call an actual conflict?
An actual conflict is one that adversely affects the representation. An actual conflict.
And where did they say that?
In Mickens. They say an actual conflict is, and that it affects the adversely affects the representation.
And that was not true in Mickens because there wasn't an actual conflict where the representation was of the victim and then subsequently of the defendant.
Mickens only dealt with one very specific issue, and that issue was, what happens when the court doesn't inquire into a potential conflict? That was the issue in Mickens. There's no issue of actual conflict. That was the issue. And Justice Scalia said in Mickens that when the court does not inquire into a potential conflict, then you have to raise an objection.
And I guess my question is, why was that situation a potential conflict only in Mickens, and how was that different from Holloway and Tyler about whether there's an actual conflict?
In Mickens, the double form of representation. In Collier, it's multiple representation. Holloway is multiple representation.
Of co-defendants at the same trial.
Right, co-defendants.
And is that different from this case?
In this, I'm going to say this case, you mean Mr. Kano's case?
Right.
Mr. Kano's case is multiple representation by the same office.
But not of co-defendants in the same trial, is that right?
It's not co-defendants. But what it is a prosecution witness, you know, and a defense witness that was that had competing interests with Mr. Kano. And because there was a competing interest, there was natural conflict. Collier was never limited to multiple representation. Collier has been applied by the Supreme Court and other courts to different issues of conflict. And I think Justice Scalia points to that issue too, saying this may be an open question, but we understand that, you know, Collier has been applied, you know, to...
And do you think in Mickens the Supreme Court is critical of that application by lower courts to broader than they did in Tyler?
I think they just said it as an issue. But when you deal with an issue of multiple representation, even when that multiple representation is imputed, then Collier is applied. I think it's clear-cut in law. There's not a situation where you have a personal interest against, you know, the attorney they have, or all the other different situations where Justice Scalia listed as to where Collier may not apply. Mr. Kano's case is different. This falls squarely in the context of multiple representation. At the time a new trial took place, the rules of professional conduct were in effect, Rule 1.10. It clearly indicated, this is going to be issued with a cross petition, but it clearly indicated that public defenders, legal aid organizations, the rule of prudence qualification applied to them. There's a duty imposed by that rule, there's a duty of loyalty, which is again the most fundamental duty of the right, the constitutional right to counsel. So even though Justice Scalia made an open question whether it's the whole conflict, you know, do you apply a Collier standard or do you apply a Strickland standard, Mr. Kano's case is specific. And the Court of Appeals found this too. In this case, you do apply the color standard. This is multiple representation by one attorney. And that's my position. I think that if this court could be faithful to its precedent, to hold otherwise, essentially saying that this court didn't know what it was doing, didn't understand Collier. Collier was clear. It's concise. If you don't object, you have to show an adverse effect, an inadequacy of the representation. And this court found that because counsel had actively represented competing interests, and he had a duty to both these clients that is competing interests. That's the adverse effect. This court had it right. And this is proven, 30 years later by the highest court, unanimously by the highest court in New York State. In addition, this court has another reason why not to impose a more difficult standard than Castro. It's because when you have a situation where attorney is making decisions under constraint of inconsistent duties, you're affecting the integrity of the trial and of the conviction. This court has an interest in protecting the integrity and legitimacy of the convictions by not having a trial where counsel is actively representing competing interests. This court has decades of precedent where this court asserts the integrity of the proceeding is paramount.
Could I follow up just a little? So where we don't have a situation in which it's apparent on its face because the attorney is representing two different defendants at the same trial who have competing interests. Where that's not the case, and you would like to make that rule a little broader and say wherever there are competing interests, take it to this case. What is apparent on the face of these two representations that hits the representation of the witness against that of the defendant, such that it would be obvious on the face of it that there is prejudice or adverse effect by the public defender's office representing both?
Okay, I think in order to answer that question, I got to briefly say the facts of the case. And essentially what happened was that this individual was stabbed at a gang party. Before this person was stabbed, he was threatened by other gang members because he wanted to leave the gang, okay? He was invited to this party the night of the party. These gang members who threatened him enticed him to come to the party. Before this night of the party, they hadn't spoken for months, okay? And these are the same people who threatened him previously. He goes to the party, everybody's acting strangely. This is a gang party, everybody acts strangely to him. He goes up the stairs, he gets stabbed. Sergio Aguilar is the witness at issue here. Sergio Aguilar says he knows my client. He knows him. He's seen him at his apartment. He's seen him at the other parties. The first thing he tells the police, I was behind the guy when he was stabbed, and he fell onto me, and I don't know who the person stabbed him. Okay. The individual who was stabbed is in the car. He gets police stop him. There's an ambulance there, and the victim's girlfriend points to him when she says, "What does this person look like? What was he wearing? What does the hair look like?" She points to Sergio Aguilar. In his car there was a gang book. Okay, and this gang book had names of these different gang people. These gang people were the people who threatened him previously, and were the same people who enticed him to come to the party, and were the same people who testified against Mr. Kano that he was the person. This gang book was located in his car, Sergio Aguilar's car. Sergio Aguilar testified for the state during the motions hearing. He says that I didn't see, I'm not sure he was at the party, I didn't pick him out on an ID. Says all this very good stuff. After he testifies, guess what happens? Sergio Aguilar gets involved in a drive-by gang shooting. He shoots someone from another gang. In his car is his girlfriend, Amber Madrigal, who, by the way, changed her testimony right after the shooting took place when he was in jail. The DA in this case apparently goes to this witness's house, Amber Madrigal's house, where she says she tried to barter her testimony against my client in exchange for the prosecutor in Mr. Kano's case lowering the bail. Mr. Kano's attorney testified, yes, he could have been, described as an alternate suspect in this case. Yes, he could provide very exculpatory material in this case. But we were afraid that he was going to change his testimony because he got arrested. And we would have to impeach him. We're going to have to impeach him with what he previously said.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Let me ask you this question in relation to that. Does that lengthy recitation of facts explaining why it was prejudicial in this case cut in favor or against your argument and suggest rather that prejudice or adverse effect is not always true on the basis of this kind of a conflict, but rather it requires a factual determination at a 35 hearing whether the second prong of Strickland has been met?
Well, I think it's not a Strickland, it's a Collier analysis, okay? And the act.
And I guess that's the question.
It is, because it's multiple representation. It was competing interest. They had a duty of loyalty to this witness, Sergio Aguilar. They also had a duty of loyalty to my client.
And so the facts that you told us are not really important with regard to this then?
Yes, it is, because it shows you where the duty of loyalty is. They had to attack him if he testified to get this exculpatory material out. He may have taken the fifth in order to get this game book in, but they had to lay a foundation for him to get it. If he's going to take the fifth, who are they going to argue against, with regards to the scope of the Fifth Amendment privilege?
Counsel, the district court judge, I think, made findings to the effect that the attorney did not call Aguilar because of this conflict, and further, that it wasn't even certain that the attorney knew that there was a conflict because of the really bad system that they had up there for figuring out conflicts. So how does that factor into your argument, these very specific district court findings about this specific situation?
Well, I think the district court findings, number one, are incorrect. In regards to...
But they're supported by evidence.
Well, I think...
They're not. Are you telling us that they're clearly erroneous or that you just don't agree with them?
Well, I think when Justice Berman, we have oral arguments in this case, co-counsel, attorney Conyers was aware, essentially, it was not disputed that he was aware that another attorney was representing Sergio Aguilar. That's in the minute 22 of oral arguments. In addition, in the Mr. Kano's trial...
Wait, let's stick with this one particular point. So you're saying that these district court findings are clearly erroneous, but there's no basis in the evidence to support them.
What I'm saying is incorrect, because co-counsel was aware that another attorney was represented in his office, represented this witness. In Mr. Kano's file was the information of Sergio Aguilar's case, was the arrest warrant, the arrest affidavit. This was all in his file. This is what Allen and Rodriguez talked about. This is the reason why we impute accomplice with information from other attorneys is going to end up in Mr. Kano's case, in another attorney from public defender's case. That's why we have to impute this qualification. That's what actually happened in this case. And the issue is that one counsel knew another attorney was representing him. The other counsel had every reason to believe that another attorney wasn't going to represent him, because he was arrested over a week before the trial started. She testified that the pickup policy that attorney will be appointed during that period of week. So she had all the circumstances were there for her to understand that that another attorney was being represented. And I say the court was clear. This is something not disputed by the people. The other co-counsel was aware that another attorney was representing him at this time. It was a competing interest. He had a duty to attack him. There was a lot of exculpatory material that he could provide at trial. In order to get that, they would have to impeach him. They could have used the information from Sergio Aguilar's case, which was in Mr. Kino's file, to impeach and to go after the credibility of Amber Madrigal, because she was in the car from the drive-by shooting, and as suggested by a prosecutor prior to the trial, that she suggested legal exposure as an accomplice. They didn't use any of that information against Mr.
Okay, I just want to make sure I have your position then. So do you think that the district court, when he found that the decision not to call Aguilar was not based on his, that is, Aguilar's representation, while other members of the public defender's office is also clearly erroneous?
No, I think number one is that you have to look at the adverse effect test, okay? either you can apply the cash flow test, or you can apply what the Federal Circuit's applied, which is a plausible of the ultimate defense or strategy, and that defensive strategy was in conflict with their other duties of interest, but was not done because of their other duties of interest. If you apply the federal standard, it doesn't make a difference whether a counsel didn't do it because of the conflict. It's an objective standard, and you look at the circumstances. You look at whether or not there was an alternative defense, and was that defense, you know, in conflict of what your other duties and interests. And that's exactly what happened in Mr. Kano's case. And the reason why the federal test does that is because, as I cited in my brief, the psychology of conflict of interest, counsel's post-conviction conflict testimony is unreliable. Okay, there's an unconscious bias in this to say that what they're saying is correct. This is supported by empirical evidence that post-conviction counsel's testimony is unreliable. You can't believe what they're going to say because of the unconscious effect that the conflict places upon the attorney. And what's remarkable, this study was done in the late 2000s. Castro, back in 1982-83, said, you know, the reason why we can't prove specific things is because of how the conflict unconsciously manifests itself in attorney's representation. This court was aware of the unconscious effect that conflict places upon the attorney. It also indicates the unreliability of conflicted counsel's testimony. So if this court's going to deny this conflict motion solely based upon that, essentially what the court is doing there is making, is converting this Collier test into a Strickland test. Because by saying that they did not do it because of the conflict, they're essentially making a strategic exception to it. There was other reasons to do it. And if you look at the federal test, that's not part of it. What's good about the federal test, it diminishes the role of attorneys' post-conviction conflict testimony. Because all the federal circuits understand that it's unreliable. You can't. When you have a conflict of interest, it's different than ineffective assistance as something that the counsel did not do. It's different because the conflict has unconscious effects on counsels, how they take the conflict and how they think it may affect their representation. It's unreliable, and you can't rely on counsel's testimony, and that's what this court did. And that's why it's inaccurate. If you're going to prove an adverse effect, and if you're going to prove more of what is required by cash flow, then you should adopt, you know, the federal standard. Because in the very least, that's better than this standard, because I don't have to show how a conflict influenced the strategic decision. To show an influence, I'm going to have to prove that the unconscious effects, how the conflict affected the decision-making process. And that's an impossible burden. I'm never going to be able to do that. Okay? And that's why I'm asking either court to apply the standard in Castro. The adverse effects is the impairment of the duty of loyalty, the constraint that a common place is upon a decision, attorney's decision-making process. That's the adverse effect. Any questions?
Well, I think Justice Coates' point, I don't mean to speak for him, but as I understand it, is so under the federal test, if we were to adopt that, you seem to contend, at least implicitly, that you could meet that test through the recitation of the evidence that you just summarized for us now.
Right. That's certainly my position. And my position is that, yes, it's conflict affecting their representation. And if you apply the federal test, you know, which is done pursuant to, I guess, you know, the Supreme Court jurisprudence, and taking account the unconscious effects of what a conflict does, then yes, I mean, that is my position.
Well, when you say the federal test, you mean the test that's summarized in Nicholson, the Fourth Circuit decision?
I think it's the Collidero, the First Circuit test. It's a plausible alternative defense strategy, and that strategy was in conflict with their other duties and interests.
Right.
Or could have not been taken because there are other duties.
And then there's the third problem about the alternate.
I think the only difference between the federal standard and the circuit is the reasonableness of the alternative defense. And I think the 10th Circuit and some other circuits say it has to be objectively reasonable. Right. The other circuits, First, Second, and the Fifth Circuit say it's a plausible plausible alternative defense. So the only difference between the circuits is the objective reasonableness of the alternative defense. Otherwise, I think they are pretty similar to the federal test.
But I gather what you're saying is that even under the more onerous test that includes the plausibility problem, that you could pass that too.
The possibility.
The 10th Circuit version, 4th Circuit version.
I represent my client, I'm going to advocate for him, and my position, yes, you know, they'll be able to meet that test, okay? But I think they may have to have a hearing about this, or the court's going to have to make a finding regardless of this test, okay? But the test, they have more purpose, is to protect the duty of loyalty, and also understand that you don't know how conflict affects the representation of the individual. So, it was passed in this case, the duty of loyalty was agreed upon, and counsel had to make decisions with impermissible consideration, under the constraint, casualty, but encumbrance, that's the reversal, that's the duty of loyalty. Like, 5 minutes left, and I haven't reached the error across my tissue issue, but let me just say this, because of course, it's an issue, okay? You know what, I don't think they properly raised it. It's been in my brief. They argued that because of the issue of the test to apply, it depends upon what the court knows, and that's an issue even against, it's not what the court knows whether the defense counsel made an objection or not. I think they sort of now are adjusting their argument, that misconception that they originally raised in the conditional cert petition. But let me just say this. What's relevant is what the rules at the time of trial. Was the conflict at the time of trial, that's what's relevant. I cited to the case of Bob Lee versus Van Hook, the Supreme Court case, where the Supreme Court essentially essentially mocked the Sixth Circuit by indicating why would you apply rules that, you know, ADA standards that didn't apply, that weren't in effect at the time. Clearly what's relevant are the rules that applied at that time. The rules, Rule 1.10, did not have the government attorney language in it. And as I indicated, public defenders are not government attorneys. They don't know why they should be considered public attorneys. But I don't think the court even gets there. I think Rule 1.10 understood that there was, that loyalty exists within the law firm, and also imposed the duty of loyalty in the law firm. So the rule provided notice to attorneys that they had a duty to other members, other clients of their regional public defender's office. In addition, it's not only just the rule, it's also this court's precedent. Both Allen and Rodriguez, this court said, you review conflicts between the public defender's office. In addition, the public defender's conflict policy says, you conflict go off when you have a prosecution witness or a witness represented by another attorney with the regional defender's office. So it's all consistent. The time of trial, everyone said, this is a conflict. You review conflicts at this time. And that's what the court appeals found. They also indicated that even the practices and the environment of particular public defender's office where they consulted with each other, they adopt loyalty to the other attorney's clients. This all shows why the community's qualification rule should be applied in a situation as the court appeals did in this case. And with 3 minutes left, I'm going to leave the rest of very well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Brady.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people. Mackenzie Taylor says that an actual conflict of interest is a term of art, referring to a conflict that affected counsel's performance, as opposed to a mere theoretical division of lawyers. It is defined by reference not to the nature of the alleged conflict itself, but to the effect of the conflict on the attorney's ability to advocate effectively. Now, this court in Armstrong noted the tension between Kyler and Castro, but as pointed out in Justice Quinn's concurrence, it was an open question until the United States Supreme Court decides. Now, the United States Supreme Court has decided, and that's in its detail. As far as proof difficulties, In United States v. Berger, the United States Supreme Court says that respect for the bar and deference to two reviewing courts is enough. Plus, the trial court's credibility findings regarding the defense counsel's motivations are checked against the record. So that's some objective evidence. In United States v. Chronic, the United States Supreme Court said, effective assistance of counsel means did defendant get a fair trial. When we're in post-conviction review, we can look back and see what happened at the trial and see, regardless of any alleged conflicts, did the defendant get a fair trial? And the way we do that is we see if counsel's conflict adversely affected the way counsel presented the case. As far as the defendant's argument, we should not punish defendants for counsel's misconduct and not objecting. We assume that attorneys act in the client's best interest based on their experience. And again, the trial court and reviewing courts are capable of determining if there was a Sixth Amendment violation. Regarding the test that we've been applying here in Colorado is fairly general. The test is, did counsel choose to do something or not to do something, and was that influenced by the conflict? In United States v. Nicholson, the federal test is defined. That test is a little more specific, and the people would urge this court to follow. That test is, did counsel fail to pursue a plausible alternative defense strategy, and was that failure linked to the conflict? And the reason why that test is more specific and easy to apply is because there might be some things that counsel chose to do or not do that really had no effect on the attorney presenting the defense strategy. If defense counsel cannot name a different strategy that was not pursued, or that the strategy that was pursued was not effectively pursued because of a conflict, then he can prove adverse effect. Turning to the issue of imputation,
before you go to imputation, can I just ask you, do you adopt, I guess, the same, you said, well, here's the Supreme Court has said adverse effect is required, and I'm wondering, I mean, there's certainly language in the opinion saying that, but what is the scope of that? Where does adverse effect apply, in your view?
It applies on post-conviction review.
Does it depend on whether there was an objection or no objection?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, exactly. We're not looking at, is there an actual conflict versus a potential conflict? Those are things that can be done at trial. But when we're in post-conviction review, it's objection versus non-objection.
Okay, thank you.
Turning to imputation of conflicts, that makes sense when we're at trial or in a Rule 21 proceeding, when this court is trying to determine if counsel should be disqualified because of imputed conflicts. On post-conviction review, it doesn't really make sense because, again, we're looking to see, did the conflict adversely affect? And imputation is something that's really done beforehand. In post-conviction review, we're really just looking at, did defendant get a fair trial? Any questions about that?
What does that actually mean? That what you're saying in terms of, do you think that the rules of professional conduct, what role should they play?
Well, during the trial, of course, the rules do govern the attorney's behavior. And of course, they would be subject to disciplinary proceedings, and none of us want that. But in regard to a Sixth Amendment analysis, that's post-conviction, where we can actually look at the case and see what happened. If we're going to apply the rule of imputation, then the people have argued that we should apply the new rule that excludes government attorneys, based on the fact that it doesn't really make sense to impute conflict after the fact. Any other questions? This case will need to be remanded. The trial court applied the wrong standard and didn't make complete findings. So the people would request that this court find the adverse effect is the test, and remand the case.
Actually, counsel, before you step away from the podium, just to be clear, you started off articulating the Kenny standard and saying that's a very general one, and then you referred us to the federal standard as being more specific. Are you urging us
to adopt the federal standard and abandon Kenny, or I just want to clarify exactly what your position is.
Yes, John, I'm urging you to adopt the standard as it's set forth in the United States v. Nicholson. Counsel failed to pursue a plausible alternative defense strategy, and the failure was linked to the conduct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes for the vote.
With regards to the people's argument that applying the rules of professional conduct in a post-conviction analysis, and then specifically the rules of imputed disqualification or imputed conflicts, the conflict was imputed on the post-conviction level too. The purpose of the rules of this rule is to protect the duty of loyalty, right? So it obviously is germane and compelling evidence that the duty of loyalty was imperative, that the duty of, that the rule of imputed disqualification was breached. So clearly you should apply the rule of imputed disqualification in post-conviction analysis, because its purpose, its design is to protect the right to counsel and the fundamental duty of loyalty. And that's why it's relevant in the post-conviction analysis. With regards to applying the new rule, and again, I don't think this court needs to reach that issue in this case, but the assumption that public defense and government attorneys, I think, is an incorrect assumption. And I follow Justice Coates' dissent in Sherry. You look at the plain language of the rules, it doesn't make sense. Public defenders don't represent the government. They represent the people being prosecuted by the government. The duty of loyalty is not toward the government. Their duty of loyalty, by the rules of disqualification, apply to the people they represent. And I think there needs to be some clarification, because I think it has to be clear by this court that public defenders are not government attorneys. Other jurisdictions came to that same conclusion. If you look at the rules, look at the policy reasons, it's not a fit. And I think this court needs to clear this up, because this court, in my case, said that legalism doesn't apply because of Sherry, and that's an incorrect assumption. I don't think it was argued in Sherry for the fact that the parties have all argued or assumed that they were government attorneys. But clearly that's not what the rules say. It's inconsistent with this court's precedent, both in Allen Marie's and also in Close and Peters. And it makes bad policy citizens. And I think that needs to be clarified. So even if this court were to apply the rules that affect in 2008, which I don't think it should, but even if it does, the rule of imputed disqualification would still apply with regards to public defenders. Does the court have any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your argument. And the court will be in recess until 1:30.